So our podcast is called Right and Wrong.
Are these your notes? These are your notes about what we're going to say.
Anything. Nailed it. It's a short answer.
So how many novels did you not finish?
Oh my God, so many.
It was perfect. What's she talking about? This is not a...
Ooh, a spicy question. I love it.
This is it, guys. The big secret to getting published is you have to write a good book. You heard it here first.
Hello, and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. My guest today is editorial director for picture books at Bloomsbury and is also now a published children's author with her debut novel Greenwild. It's Parry Thompson. Hi.
Hi, Jamie. Thank you so much for inviting me onto the podcast.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for coming on. And well, let's start with the exciting thing. Out June 1st, your debut novel. So it's not out as of us recording this, but it will be out by the time it goes live. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's called Greenwild, as you already mentioned. It's a middle grade fantasy novel, and it's about a girl called Daisy Thistledown. She's 11 years old, and she is sent to a horrible boarding school when her mother, who is a glamorous journalist, goes off to investigate a dangerous story somewhere in Peru. And then when her mother goes missing in the depths of the Amazon rainforest, Daisy knows that she has to escape from boarding school and go and look for her missing mother. And in the process, she discovers a hidden world that exists alongside our own. And this world is called the Green Wild. And inside the Green Wild is a world of green magic, a place where plants are magic. And there are all sorts of amazing things to be discovered, including the truth about what has happened to her mother. So it's a sort of fantasy adventure. It's got magic, it's got family, it's got friendship, it's got trees that grow milk chocolate, it's got a very grumpy cat.
Nice.
All the things that I enjoy in life. It was a real joy to write it, and I'm very excited for people to read it.
Well, it sounds like it has everything you would possibly want in a children's fantasy adventure. And it also greatly features Kew Gardens.
It does indeed, yes. So I'm lucky enough to live quite near Kew Gardens, and I've spent many hours wandering around and looking at all of the amazing glass houses and thinking that lots of the plants and trees there really are kind of you know, stranger than fiction. You couldn't make them up. And yeah, it really got me thinking, you know, what if you had a sort of magical version of Kew Gardens, and what if you had magical botanists who could do plant magic, and what if all of the plants really were magic? And the sort of doorway that Daisy, my main character, passes through to get into the Green Wild is through... It is sort of hidden in the depths of the palm house in Kew Gardens. So there are sort of many doorways hidden all around the world, you know, doorways in every country, and the doorway in London is hidden in Kew Gardens.
Of course.
So of course, you
Where
know,
else
it makes
would it
perfect
be?
Sense. Exactly.
So was the sort of inception of this story, did it come from you just kind of like your experience of being in Kew Gardens?
Yes, I think so. I think I've sort of had in my head for a long time the idea of a magical world with sort of magical glass houses and magical plants. And I think that I loved the idea of, you know, taking that metaphor of nature being a bit magic, because anyone who's watched, you know, a David Attenborough documentary or kind of spent any time looking at the way that a sunflower turns its head throughout the day to follow the sun, you know, you kind of think it is a little bit magic. Like, how does it all work? So I love the idea of sort of taking that and actually kind of literalizing it and just going, yeah, like it really is magic. And and I think also there's an element of kind of escapism there. I started writing it during lockdown, and I think I love the idea of an adventure that would take you into another world. And also I sort of tapped into a little bit my own childhood, because when I was 11, I was sent to a boarding school, which I absolutely hated. I was very unhappy there, and I used to fantasize about running away and escaping. So I think I've sort of channeled my own sort of 11-year-old boarding school escape fantasies into this book, which made it sort of extra specially satisfying to write.
Yes, I think people often say that the debut novel for most people is the most autobiographical.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
And this book also features some beautiful illustrations by Elisa Paganelli. I'm always curious when it comes to illustrations with books, at what point they're sort of conceived. Like, did you, whilst you were writing it, did you have ideas for illustrating certain parts of it?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So actually, I, as I was writing it, I wasn't thinking of it as something that was ever going to be published. I was very much writing it for myself as a sort of pleasant sort of brain holiday diversion, excursion in my imagination. I never expected that it would end up being published. And it was actually only because I gave it to my dad to read and he sort of encouraged me to do something with it. So I actually wasn't kind of ever thinking that it would be illustrated, you know, published, let alone illustrated. So actually that whole part of it has been a real joy because it was so unexpected. And I feel like I got incredibly lucky that, you know, Elisa agreed to illustrate the book because she is just absolutely one of the most talented and inspiring illustrators out there. And for her to kind of lend her talents to the book and bring the world of Greenwild to life was completely surreal and wonderful. And actually, you know, I think in terms of which scenes were chosen, it was really sort of Macmillan, my amazing publishers, who sort of went through and pulled out key moments that they thought might be good. And we kind of had a bit of back and forth and a bit of discussion about, you know, were we missing anything key that felt like a really kind of apt episode or kind of adventure that we wanted to see illustrated. And then kind of Elisa really just sort of took that and ran with it in an amazing way.
Yeah, no, it really does add something to those kind of, and you can see why you've chosen those specific points throughout the book. Am I right in thinking, I was going to ask, I know that you obviously work full-time in publishing. I was going to ask, is writing something that you've always done in the background? But based on what it sounds like happened with this book, is this the first time that you'd written a novel?
It is, yeah. You know, unless you count sort of my attempt, age 7, to write.
I don't know if we'll count that.
the grand adventures of I was a big fan of the Redwall book. So my attempts at writing anything at those time probably would have featured a full cast of mice and hedgehogs. So this was my first attempt to write anything. I'd sort of always wanted to write, but I had never had the time. And actually, I'm sure that this is, you know, a cliche that, you know, many people will have said the same thing. But, you know, lockdown just suddenly opened up previously unsuspected tracts of time in which actually you could do something like just write for a few hours a day. And I just never really had the luxury of being able to do that before.
But here we are, and now it's being published, and you're probably going to have to do it again.
Well, yes, that is a very good point. So Greenwild is the first in a trilogy. I'm incredibly lucky that I have sort of two more books in the story that I can write. And I have just finished writing the very, very first draft of book two, and I can tell you it was a different experience writing it now than it was writing book one during lockdown.
Equally
fun, but a little bit more more time pressured.
Yes, exactly. People, I think it's very common. Lots of the authors that I've spoken to have said book two is a very different and in some ways more kind of scary and daunting experience, because you have a time limit and you have people, they are helping you, but at the same time it's like people are there sort of like, when's the next bit going to be done, are we on time, are we on schedule, kind of thing.
Yeah exactly, that experience of actually someone waiting for it rather than it just being, you know,
exactly.
Yeah,
which you must be somewhat used to from your role in editorial on the other side, being the person waiting for it.
Yes, it's actually been such a fascinating experience being on the other side of the line. And I have to say, it's given me a whole new insight into what my authors go through all the time. And I kind of feel like it's like some kind of great karmic retribution for all the times that I've, you know, nudged someone on a deadline. I'm now experiencing it for myself. But yes.
You're editorial director within Picture Books, and do you do anything beyond, or is it just Picture Books?
Yes. So I work on sort of illustrated books for sort of, I guess, anywhere from age 0 to about 6 or 7. So yeah, uh-huh. It is very much focused on picture books, which is a kind of very joyful and an inspiring place to work, actually. And I think for anyone who loves both words and pictures, it's a really wonderful job to have, because it's equal parts word related and visual, which is lovely.
Was there ever a part of you that thought, maybe I will try doing a picture book instead of just kind of going straight into a full kind of prose manuscript?
Actually, that never occurred to me. And I think it's because the discipline of writing a picture book, I'm convinced it's far harder to write than middle grade.
Yeah.
It is something about the compression of the form. Your word count is so limited that each word, you know, has to be absolutely pitch perfect. And the people who do it well are real artists, and I'm not sure I could do it. I love editing picture books, and I love working with my picture book authors, and I'm continually in awe of their talents.
Yes. It's sort of like picture books, although, you know, you can read them and ostensibly you're like, oh, well, this is a very simple, clear, easy to write thing. The creation of that is such an intricate puzzle of like very carefully thought out and calculated design and spacing, and like each word choice, as you say, is down to, you know, the decibels, the number of syllables and things like that. Yeah. It's so highly thought out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the mark of a good picture book is that it looks and seems effortless, and you as a reader don't have an inkling of all of the work that will have gone on behind the scenes to make it feel that kind of without effort.
Exactly. That's it. Like when you read a really good novel and you think, oh no, the prose isn't very fancy and flowery and it's very easy to follow and things like that. And like, that's such a skill to be able write something that reads very simply, but actually conveys complex emotions on many levels.
Yeah, it really is. I couldn't agree more.
Let's get back onto you. It's always great to have industry folks on the podcast. So you were recently promoted to editorial director, previously senior commissioning editor. For your current role, editorial director, what, in sort of simple terms, what's the crux of the role? What's the day-to-day that you're up to?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And one that I'll try my best to answer. see if even I know what my job is.
That'd be good.
Yes. So,
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, that there is a strong commissioning element, as there was in my previous role. So there's a lot of reading of submissions and signing up and sort of pitching of texts to the wider company that, you know, I think are amazing picture books that we want on the list. And then I'm also very involved in the process of finding the right illustrator for each text. So in a lot of ways, there's a kind of matchmaking element to the job, finding the exact right artist to go with the story. And there is a kind of sort of chemistry or kind of magic that happens when you get the right match of text and illustrator that is really exciting. And then, you know, beyond that, I work in a very hands-on way to edit the text with the author, with our amazing design team to sort of brief the text to the illustrator. And then you kind of get the roughs in and then you get the artwork in. And actually, that's one of the best bits of the job, is when sort of new artwork lands in your inbox and you think, okay, today is going to be a good day. Because there's kind of a real joy in seeing what another person's imagination has brought to a text, and kind of how they bring it to life. So there's a lot of that. And then, you know, running alongside that kind of more creative side, there's a sort of slightly more analytical side, which is about, okay, you know, what's working in the market? What's the shape of the list? What's our strategy? What do we need to commission? You know, what are the numbers here, in a sort of slightly more hard-headed way. Yeah. So it's a really good balance of those two things. And I think one of the things that I love about it is that no 2 days are the same. I might be in a covers meeting, kind of having a really serious discussion with the sales team about, you know, why we definitely need more gold foil and sparkle on that cover. or I could be, you know, having a meeting with an author talking about ideas for their next picture book, or I could be in a more kind of numbery, financy, salesy meeting. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's okay. a whole range of things, and it's sort of unpredictable and always unexpected and fun.
Okay. Sounds great. I mean, any role where you do the full range from creative to analytical, I think is always a fun experience, always changing, always something new.
Definitely.
Based on what you just said and looking at the book in front of me, are you very pro gold foil on books?
Do you know, I have to say, I was so delighted when Macmillan said that they were thinking about putting gold foil on the cover, because I think I'm definitely a bit of a magpie in the sense that I like sparkly things.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, they've the Macmillan design team and Elisa have done the most amazing job on the cover, and it really does look beautiful.
It does.
The other thing that pleases me a lot about the book in its finished form is that it has a map on the end papers.
Yes.
And this is something that makes me so happy, because when I was a child and I was such a huge bookworm, I read everything, but I knew that when I opened a book and it had a map at the start, I knew it was going mm-hmm. to be a good book. And I still remember I still have copies of the Chronicles of Narnia, and I remember the wonderful maps at the start of them, and that kind of feeling of, okay, here we go, we're about to step into a wonderful adventure. So that really is a kind of childhood dream come true, that that my book has a map in it. It's wonderful.
Yeah. As someone who reads a lot of fantasy, there's definitely a feeling that if I open a book and there's not a map at the start, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, no, I know. They're missing a trick, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless it's set in the real world, contemporary, and it's just a map of the UK, and you're like, well, okay. Jumping back into what we were just talking about, you were saying sometimes your job can be quite analytical and you're looking at markets and things like that. Interesting things happening in publishing at the moment, especially with, I mean, this is not new, but the kind of roller coaster that is TikTok and BookTok has sort of made trends a very prevalent thing within the industry, especially in like young adult. Are there sort of big trends that influence picture books in the same way?
That's a really good question. I would say that the picture book market is probably slightly more insulated than most from the TikTok phenomenon, just because the consumers are probably less likely to be on it. But at the same time, you know, I think you definitely do see kind of waves of different things. I think we've had a few years of some really wonderful and inspiring, quite sort of message-based picture books, for sure. A lot of picture books about sort of tackling worry and anxiety for small children, I think, is definitely something that we've seen. And that's not surprising, given the last few years that we've had. And I think a lot of the discussions that I'm now having with other publishers and with agents is about kind of a need for picture books also that are just purely silly and joyful and escapist, and maybe don't necessarily need to have a very strong message attached to them, but are just going to be books that, you know, parents and small children are just going to have a lot of fun reading together. And of course, I think the other trend, you know, and I think this is across the whole industry, is about kind of increasing the kind of representation on the list and making sure that the authors and illustrators who we publish and the characters and the stories that they tell are kind of a good reflection of the society that we're all living in. And I think that is, and, you know, rightly continues to be a very important concern.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. And when you talk about having not having a message, I think this some books do a great job of sort of having a message, but without sort of hitting you over the head with it. And
yes.
I mean, in many ways, Greenwild has a sort of strong ecological message, but it's not, you don't, whilst reading it, you don't think, oh, this is very like pushing save the planet kind of themes upon me.
Oh, I'm really glad you said that. I definitely wanted it to not feel sort of too messagey or too sort of patronizing. I remember very clearly as a child that the thing that would put me off most in a book would be feeling that I was being spoken down to in some way or kind of dictated to. And I think, you know, the best children's books are books that, you know, meet the child on their own level and don't underestimate the kind of ferocious intelligence and perspicacity of child readers. You know, that's why, you know, something like, you know, His Dark Materials is so wonderful and thrilling to read. You know, I remember reading it as a sort of 10, 11 year old, and I loved it because I felt that it expected me to step up to its level. And that was a really thrilling and exciting place to be.
Yeah, I do. I've always thought that historically His Dark Materials was sold in an age group that was slightly too young for the actual age that it should be sold for. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean. I think now I wonder if it would be marketed more as a YA. But
I do see it in bookshops. They put it in the YA section now.
Yes, yeah. I think you're right. But yeah, at the same time, I'm kind of glad that I read it when I did, because I felt that it was one of those things that really kind of, you know, opened up your kind of sense of what books could do in a really exciting way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. And also, you know, putting an age on a book is sort of such a loose guideline, because everyone reads at a different pace, at a different, you know, everyone definitely wants to consume different things at different times. So
definitely.
Getting back onto you, let's talk about the difference between, so you obviously have spent a lot of time, very experienced, you know, the ins and outs of how picture books work and kind of going through from first picking up an author all the way through to that being published. Was it what you expected when you went through it with Greenwild, this book, this middle grade fantasy novel? Was it kind of very different, or kind of as you expected?
Actually, I think I didn't know what to expect because even though I kind of knew, as you say, a lot of the mechanics of how it would all work, I think what I didn't expect was, you know, how it would feel when it was kind of to do with my own book.
Yeah.
And I think it's been a real joy kind of working with an editor and kind of experiencing that from the other side, kind of had things that were kind of challenging and rewarding that I hadn't anticipated. In kind of a good way, I think, you know, having an editor challenge you to kind of, you know, make your writing the best it can be. And I think I was very lucky in that the book is being published by Macmillan in the US and in the UK. So I actually had two editors, which was something that I hadn't occurred to me would happen. So there were kind of two sets of feedbacks and two sets of comments on each draft, and kind of two sets of proofreads and two sets of copy edits. So it kind of proliferated in a way that I hadn't expected.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was very interesting.
Are they the same, or are they sort of two slightly different versions for US UK?
They're almost identical. Okay. It's things like you know, the spelling
vocab
and
stuff.
Vocab and yeah. Exactly, you know, like sweater versus jumper and all of those kind of details.
Sidewalk.
Yes, and sort of different commas. I've spent a lot of time, much more time than I would have expected at the start of the process, discussing commas.
Okay, I didn't realize it was so wildly different.
Yeah, it's been a real kind of education, and but also a real kind of privilege to work with two editors who both have such a good sense of what works for their different markets.
Oh, great. That's really good. And always interesting to get those perspectives from different markets. As someone who, I imagine you focus mainly on the UK market, so the picture book market would be very different in the US. So I guess that would be really interesting to see how that would work.
Yeah, exactly. They are two incredibly different markets. And actually, especially in the picture book sphere, I feel that in sort of the, especially the YA arena, especially because a lot of it is kind of US generated, or it's kind of easier for it to travel, as you say, kind of globally via, you know, social media and things like TikTok for that age group. There tends to be a lot more crossover, but, you know, especially for picture books, it's fascinating to see kind of what works in the US versus what works here.
Yes. And sort of confusing, because you're like, no, but this has been really good for us. Like, and it just doesn't work there. I don't understand.
exactly.
Before we get to what is always the final question, I'd love to ask, as someone who is in the industry and has been around picture books for a long time, for anyone listening who is thinking about or has written or is writing picture books, what advice would you give them in terms of breaking into what is a very tough nut to crack with picture books?
Yeah, that's a great question. As you say, it is a tough one. I think partly because it's very competitive. A lot of people, perhaps because it's such a short format, a lot of people are trying to write picture books.
Yeah.
And it is a real art form, and it's very hard to do it well. I would say it's definitely worth... this probably is a very obvious thing to say, but, you know, sort of seeking out and reading and learning from the greats. So, you know, go back to, you know, the real classics, whether that's, you know, something like The Very Hungry Caterpillar or Where the Wild Things Are, or, you know, Julia Donaldson. She's great for a reason. She really knows what she's doing with the rhythm and the rhyme. And I think there are also some amazing mentoring schemes that are definitely worth looking into. And that, you know, are run by agencies and publishers. So I think those are definitely worth doing. I know that on the illustration side, there's a scheme called the Picture Hook Scheme, where you can, as an illustrator, sign up to be mentored by a kind of working successful illustrator for a year. So, you know, there are all sorts of things to seek out that can kind of help give you a leg up. And beyond that, I would say that, you know, as you write, you have to bear in mind, always it has to be in your mind as a picture book writer that you are writing something that is going to be illustrated. So you need to leave space for the illustrations to do their work. And it is really a sort of joint enterprise, I would say, between the text and the illustration. So the art of a really good picture book is a text that kind of almost doesn't overcrowd, but that leaves those pauses where the artwork can kind of step in and do its magic.
Yes, I've never written picture books or dared to try, because as you say, it sounds very difficult, but that does sound like a very good thing to keep in mind whilst you are making your creation. So hopefully that's useful for anyone listening who is in the picture book world. And that brings us on to the final question, which as always is, Parry, if you were stranded on a desert island with a single book, which book would it be?
I have agonized over this question. it's so incredibly difficult to answer.
Yeah, it's just not fair.
I know, it's very, very difficult. I think that I thought about saying Journey to the River Sea. It's a book that I loved when I was growing up by a wonderful author called Eva Ibbotson, and it's about a girl called Maya. She's an orphan who's sent to live with her relatives in the Amazon rainforest, and that kind of sense of adventure, even though it's sort of rooted in very much in the real world, was very much kind of inspiring to me as I was writing my own books. So I would definitely encourage anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of reading that to go out to seek it out and find it. I also thought about taking a book by Diana Wynne Jones, who's another mm-hmm. one of my sort of all-time favorite children's authors, and I think my favorite of her books is Howl's Moving Castle, which a lot of people will have come across because of the completely wonderful Studio Ghibli adaptation, but if you haven't read it, the book is also completely magical. And it's about a girl called Sophie who is kind of cursed or enchanted into the form of a sort of old crone. She lives in a sort of fairy tale world, and she has to find a way to break this curse and sort of find her way back to her own true self. And there's a very sort of characterful wizard called Howl, who lives in a sort of castle that travels all over the place, and I think for sheer fantasticalness and imagination and kind of sense of invention and delight, it's a very hard one to beat for middle grade. And I think it would be a wonderful book to have with you on a desert island.
I completely agree. What a great choice as well. I'd not thought about, we've never had that on the podcast before. So Howl's Moving Castle, that's a great choice. I endorse this message. Well, thank you so much, Parry, for coming on the podcast and telling us all about your brand new book, Green World, the world behind the door.
That's right.
Part one of three. It's been really amazing chatting with you about that and hearing all about your work in publishing, in editorial. It's been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for anyone listening, if you want to keep up with what Parry is doing, you can follow her on Twitter at Parry Thompson. And to make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, follow along on all socials and support us over on Patreon. And for more bookish chat, you can check out my other podcast, The Chosen Ones and Other Tropes. Thanks again to Parry, and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.